curfew has been put in place, and also I'm not allowed to like get out of bed until 7, but I break that because she's not awake to enforce it.
It's a little underhanded.
Yeah. I mean, she's instituting a curfew on me. So I guess what brings that up already, dear listeners, is that when we stream on Twitch on Thursday nights at 6 p.m., we have a little pre-show fun, and friend of the show, Matt, on Twitch, MattM14, was talking about how sleep is becoming more and more important. And then I mentioned how Jamie has instituted a curfew in our apartment, and I'm to go to bed at 10 o'clock with no phone, and I'm not to get out of bed until after 7 a.m.
That's not a curfew, man. That's a sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. So
no, honestly, it's probably perfectly reasonable.
It is perfectly reasonable to be honest. Like, then I waste less time during the day because I'm like, I have to go to bed at 10. That means I have to do this now. I can't do it later.
Can't scroll through Twitter later.
Yeah, but yeah. So I've been trying to work on my sleep more.
That's good. I've been doing the opposite. I was up till 3 a.m. one night just messing around with Tailwind style sheets on a side project website that doesn't really matter, which I'll talk more about later. And then I was up till 2 a.m. last night playing Elite Dangerous with my friend who I've been trying to play with him for weeks. And we finally had some time that overlapped to play where he wasn't doing his raids on WoW with his guild.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, just woke up from a nap. It's 9 o'clock here. It's not going great.
Naps are... I sometimes tell people that I'm taking Watson on a walk and then I'll take a nap instead.
That's pretty good. Then you have a napping buddy, right?
Watson, yeah, he loves to just jump in the bed whenever. He's not allowed to be in it at night because he takes up too much room and he's too selfish. He's a selfish sleeper. He crawls in the middle. Again, he's 80 pounds. Actually, we just weighed him. He's 80 pounds. He stands up to my, like, just above my knees, and I'm almost 6'1". So he's pretty big. And he lays on his side, and he needs to have his legs outstretched, which means that I have to sleep on the floor, basically. So whenever he can get in the bed during the day, he's happy to.
And you're just over there sleeping on like the dog bed on the floor?
Basically. I just get in his cage. I get in his like little, his kennel. Sleep in that. Yeah.
So Monday did a little live stream on our channel. It was kind of impromptu, and I'm actually really, really excited about how many people showed up considering it was between 10 and 1 o'clock on a Monday. And, you know, I was supposed to be working, and I'm sure a lot of people were too, but got together and watched the WWDC live stream, which is a really cool experience. It was fun to have everyone come by and with their hot takes and funny, weird things and comments and stuff with everything that was going on. But yeah, lots of thoughts on that, obviously, but it was really, really, really exciting presentation. And our Max, man, it's happening.
ARM Max. Apple SoCs.
Apple Silicon
SoCs. Yeah. I don't think I watched most of it because I was on calls and in spreadsheets as I have been the last week. But I caught up a little bit with some of the announcements. And like you were saying, you know, they talked about Apple Silicon and the new chips and all that. One thing I thought was interesting is they mentioned the ability to possibly have more laptops that didn't require fans, which I don't like because if you like to work outside at all, you'll know the 12-inch MacBook Pros will just overheat and shut off because there are no fans. If even like even the sun even like looks at or like winks at your computer, it'll overheat.
Is that true? I've never heard of that happening.
So yeah, it happens to Jamie and her mom because they both have the 12-inch MacBooks and they both like to work outside when they can. I mean, who wouldn't if they have the chance? I guess some people might not, but they do like to work outside. And yeah, it happens a lot. Where the computer will just overheat. There's no fans in to cool it down, you know? So if the sun is shining down on the metal heatsink, basically, right? The body's a heatsink. It'll sort of just shut itself down.
And then maybe you could have a 16-inch MacBook Pro that you don't have to put 9 feet away from your monitor with the fan screaming the whole time, right?
Right. So the backstory on that is, yeah, my fans are on all the time for my MacBook Pro. And so I bought this one of the LG like 5K LG monitors, the Apple monitor, well, the quote unquote Apple monitors. A friend's startup went under, and so I got one for super cheap, so I picked it up. And it came with this suspiciously long Thunderbolt cord. It must be 9 feet.
Suspiciously long.
Because I can't find another one that long. Like, you go to Apple, you know, it's, you get like the, it's like, I don't know. I don't know how many feet technically it is. It's probably like 2 feet, maybe 2.5 feet long. It's like the longest one I can find besides these third party ones on Amazon, which I don't necessarily trust. But this one came with a really long one. And so what I do is I plug my MacBook into that, and then I put my MacBook on the floor somewhere away from me so I can't hear it all the time. I'm doing it now. It's on the floor, like over there.
And so what do you have in front of you? Just a keyboard and monitor and that big lightning dock thing?
I didn't bring the dock, actually, because the 5G... So I'm in Santa Cruz, right? I'm not in Santa Rosa. So I brought my 5K display, and I didn't have to bring my dock because the display has a bunch of ports built into it. And because it's Thunderbolt, the display acts as a USB interface, basically.
Wow, you're very trusting of that whole amalgam of wires.
It's worked so far, and I don't have to hear the gentle or the hissing of my computer.
I wonder if the... fact, like, I know there are passive and active lightning cables, where the passive cables are literally just cables like you think of them, whereas the active ones have actual circuitry in the connectors on both ends to make them able to be longer or have higher data rates or something. So I wonder if it's an active cable that is designed for that.
I didn't know there was a difference, actually. I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, over a certain length you have to do that because of, you know, data rate issues and probably all kinds of weird things that are above my pay grade.
Interesting. So Web Queen in the chat says, active Thunderbolt 3 cables support Thunderbolt at 40 gigabytes data transfer, or 40 GPS per second data transfer at lengths of up to 2 meters. Optical cables are targeted later with lengths of up to 60 meters. Wow, I would love that. I could just throw my computer like in the basement. Passive lower cost cables are only capable of 20 gigabytes data transfer at 1 meter or 2 meter length, but can achieve full at a shorter length. Yes, I don't. So maybe I just have a slower data transfer cable, but that hasn't mattered to me so far. As I mean, the 5K display works fine. I don't have any sort of display issues with it, even at, you know, the smaller resolution. So I just really like to have my laptop somewhere else instead of on the desk, blowing hot air on the desk.
Sad that it has to be that way.
Yeah. But it is what it is. So anyway, yeah, I thought that was interesting, you know, them sort of like saying that's a good thing. We don't need more fans, you know, so smaller form factors. But that's not what I want. You know, what I want, I guess they fix the keyboard thing, right? I haven't actually felt one of those, but I don't necessarily want the slimmest laptop I can get. I just want something that's dependable and something that could cool itself off if it needed to.
Yeah, I watched the State of the Union, Platform State of the Union, which is the presentation after. It's a little more techy, but still pretty high level and marketing-y, but they alluded to the fact that they're exploring new power classes with these processors. So like they're scaling them up to the larger machines that can handle them. They're not just going to like throw an iPad Pro chip in a laptop. I mean, you could do that, but they're not doing that because they're different form factors and different trade-offs there. So it sounded like they were going to size these things up and make them, you know, very still power hungry and but hopefully still run cooler with more performance per watt, basically. So
yeah,
that it's basically guaranteed to happen. You know, there'll be something new out there, and I think it will be. I mean, I'm just excited, man. I'm just excited to see something different.
Yeah, I'm interested to see, and I think the rate at which, because I saw some people talking online, and basically they've been sort of held stagnant in being able to update with newer processors because Intel's sort of been stuck for the last 5 years without any sort of like real significant upgrades, whatever significant is. Again, I don't know the benchmarks. I don't pay attention to benchmarks and stuff like that. But that's one thing that I saw quite a lot is people saying that Intel really has been holding refreshes back.
Yeah. So my first Mac was an iBook G4, I believe. It was a white plastic one with a 4x3 screen, I think. And or G5, I don't remember what they had in them, but it was a PowerPC iBook, right?
Okay.
And then they came out with that was right before the Intel transition. I really dove in at that point because I was like, oh, I can still run Windows, because I was Windows hardcore up to that point and everything.
Sure.
And so I was like, oh, I'll have this safety net to fall back on if I don't like this whole Mac thing. And, you know, the rest is history, as they say.
Right.
So I've lived through that one transition, albeit briefly, And honestly, it was not that bad. And reading some of the cool stuff they're doing with Rosetta 2 and like ahead of time recompiling your Intel applications into ARM architecture. So like they run pretty fast most of the time.
That's pretty cool.
And they're doing just-in-time compilation when they need to. It's really, really amazing considering the processors are going to be maybe so much faster. Like I'm just waiting for the benchmark when someone runs an Intel binary on Apple chips and it runs faster than an Intel chip, right? Like
yeah,
using
yeah.
emulation.
Because I talked to some people and they, you know, they're talking about how fast the Apple chips really are and how fast like the iPhones are compared to some you know lower level PCs or even like an iPad, right? How fast the iPad Pro processor is. And I think the demo even in the WWDC presentation they did was running on an iPad Pro chip, wasn't it? And they were editing 4K video and they were playing back, I think they're playing back like three different instances of 4K video real time. That was pretty wild.
Yeah, I don't know if they said iPad. They said it was running the Apple chip, but they didn't really say which one necessarily.
Okay.
I mean, that the dev kits that that you're getting in the Mac Mini is I think an A12Z or something. It's the latest iPad Pro.
Don't even know what that means. What is that equivalent to?
It's the iPad Pro latest version that you get for the dev kit.
So I hear people talk about how fast they are, and that's great and all. But again, it's hard for me to quantify because I don't know all the numbers. I don't know the different benchmarks and stuff like that. So,
well, I think fast is one thing, but the performance per watt is the big thing, right? If they're designed from the ground up to be power conscious, right? And power conscious means longer battery life and less heat, right? So that
to me makes more sense, definitely. Yeah, that's definitely more appealing. So another interesting thing that's changed, even since the quarantine, like even since the beginning of the year. So last year I had been talking about looking at possibly upgrading my 15-inch MacBook Pro and not really feeling like any sort of desktop was an option, right? I feel like I need to be able to travel around. I need to be able to go to a coffee shop and work. I need to be able to get out of my apartment sometimes because I've been working from home for, I don't know, 4 years now. And so sometimes I feel like I just got to get out of here, right? And now that that's not really an option, like I can't go to the coffee shop, things like that, I've become just more comfortable maybe with the idea of maybe a desktop can work for me. Maybe like an iMac or a Mac Mini or something like that. And then I start thinking about, okay, well, you know, I'm down here in Santa Cruz now, and instead of just bringing my laptop, I brought a monitor with me, and it basically is an iMac at that point, right? And in fact, Jamie brought her iMac because we both have jobs and we need to like actually get work done and need to feel productive, and having a big screen in a dedicated office helps me with that. So her bringing her iMac and me bringing my monitor was basically like us carrying around desktops, right? So now I'm thinking like maybe iMac, or not an iMac, but maybe like a Mac Mini is something that would work for me. Maybe that's plausible. And the other thing that makes me feel like that is I've been using Windows more and I've been gaming more, right? So now that I'm not going out to coffee shops and doing stuff like that, I'm just playing more games with my family. And so I'm in there for that already. And I noticed that my laptop is just sitting in under my desk, like against the wall more and more and more. And so, yeah, that's been one big like paradigm shift that's happened to me even recently, was like maybe a Mac Mini could work for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I wouldn't buy one now.
Yeah.
If I were
definitely.
You.
Well, that's one thing that WWDC definitely cemented, because I really, really just, I cannot say how much I hate my current laptop's keyboard. It's so bad. So when I do have to use it, I just despise it. I'm still getting the double keys, and I just don't want to take it into Apple, you know, because WSL has crapped out of me twice. So I don't feel like I have a machine I can really trust, especially with a launch happening for Sidedoor next week, invites rolling out, right? Like it's just not time for that. So yeah, when I have to, like if Jamie's on an important call, then I have to grab my laptop and go in the living room. And I hate typing on it so much that I actually got a second 5K display when it was super cheap. And I have it on a rolling cart, and I can roll it up to the couch and plug my computer into it.
Are you kidding me? You've got like a rolly cart like at elementary school, and they had the big CRTs and like the VCR.
Yes, I do have one of those. So it has a guitar amp on the bottom, a guitar amp in the middle, and a 5K display on top.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'll take a picture of it when I get back to...
This is absurd.
Yeah. So I go out in the living room, and the only keyboard I have now is it's not 10 keyless, right? So it has a keypad. And the lap desk... And this is me totally complaining about stuff that doesn't really matter in the scheme of the world. but my lap desk is not wide enough for my full, what is it, 104 key or whatever keyboard and a mouse next to it. So then I have to use the laptop keyboard, and I should stop complaining now, but...
Do you hear that? Wait, hold on. Do you hear that?
The violin.
It's the world's smallest violin. It's playing just for you.
But anyway, I've been talking about upgrading my laptop, and now I'm not going to, because if they're rolling out, you know, updated devices, I don't know if they're going to... They didn't mention rolling out a new Pro at the end of the year, but it seems like I should just probably wait for the Apple Silicon instead.
You just get a Mac Pro, then you don't have to worry about the keyboard.
Web Queen just asked who in this crowd was on the AV crew in middle school or high school.
I think that was squarely directed in my direction.
Oh, you were? The AV club?
I was cool. Cool kid. Every day in the morning before class, we could go to the AV room and we'd take care of the slips. There would be like a slot in the door of the AV room, and the teachers would put in request slips for different equipment that they need. Overhead projector, bulb change was the big one. That was a big thing. Changing a bulb on an overhead projector, because these little like plug-in, you know, halogen bulbs. And then bring down a TV card at a certain time. And then the other big exciting thing we got to do was actually when there was something going on in the auditorium, it was like a video being played on the projector or whatever. We got to like run that, you know, and like get the sound set up right and microphones and use the projector and power it up and use the little board with the volume sliders. Yep.
So what does SoC even mean?
System on a chip.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to follow along with the chat here, and I don't know what they're talking about with SoCs, but yeah. So 3000 Thor says that Apple's A series chips are usually at least a year ahead of Qualcomm SoCs. If they replicate that with desktop CPUs, it'd be game changing. See, that to me is that to me means something more powerful than looking at benchmarks, I suppose. But yeah, I don't know. Like people will talk, they'll say like A series, whatever. I'm like, I don't know what that is. I'm sorry. I don't look at the benchmarks too often. So let me ask you this, though. Are you going to be running any betas this year?
Are you basing that off of what happened to me a couple days ago?
No, I don't know what happened to you a couple days ago.
So I've never in my life installed a beta of an Apple operating system on my phone, on my laptop, on my watch, nothing, right? Because I just don't care. I don't need it. I'm not into the ecosystem enough as a Apple developer to need to run the betas, and I like my operating system to be nice and stable so I can get my work done. But I got my nice new 16-inch MacBook Pro. It's got a ton of storage on it, and I was like, oh, I can go in and get that. I want to play with the beta for the new macOS Big Sur.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, go into Disk Utility, make a new, they don't call them partitions, it's called containers, I think, because it's an APFS thing. And the cool thing about containers, you don't have to give it a size. It just kind of somehow magically shares the space with the other container.
Okay.
I don't know exactly how it works. It's confusing. But so I made this container, rebooted into recovery mode, installed Catalina, then installed the cert or profile, whatever, provisioning profile, then upgraded to Big Sur beta, which shows up as Mac OS 11.0 in system info, which is kind of cool. And that whole process took, you know, most of half of a day to like... takes several hours to download these 4 gigabyte files.
Really?
Over here it does.
Okay.
And then as soon as I boot into it for the first time, I get a message from Paul in the Discord. And I'll put a link to this Twitter in the show notes, this tweet. But basically, if you install, and there's this note buried like at the bottom of the README for this beta release, that if you install it on the same APFS volume as a production version of macOS, that production version of macOS will never receive updates.
Oh, no.
I thought I was doing the one right thing and like, oh, I'll split it off. I won't run it as my main OS. I just want to try it and destroy it. And now I don't know what. I don't know if I just have to reformat my MacBook and just start over if I ever want to get an OS update again. What a pain.
You don't need them. They're just more buggy, right? As the years go on.
I mean, you're not wrong.
That's so every year, like 3000 Thor says, they can't be talked out of bad decisions and they're going to install them the minute they go public. Every year I sort of install them as well. But this year I don't feel that compulsion for whatever reason. I don't know why. I really like some of the features, but I think maybe some of the features that I'm looking forward to, especially with like messages, nobody in my family is going to be on the beta, so I can't really use them. Like who's going to reply? No one could reply to a thread, right? So I think maybe some of the features I'm most excited about are, I'll have to wait till other people are on the new versions as well. But I was really impressed with what's this the feature called, Scribble on iPad OS. That was really cool. And that's because Jamie's always talking to me about how she wish she could hand write more stuff, because she has an iPad and a pencil and it does wonders for studying and research for her. And she's always having to switch between them. And now that she can just like tap it and input and scribble in it and have it turn into text, I mentioned that to her and she's like, no way, because she wasn't watching the presentation and she went and looked it up. And she's really excited about that feature. To me, that's the kind of stuff that's like super cool in my eyes. Like, yeah, there's a lot of features that me as a tech person are interested in, but that was like revolutionary to her.
Just the Newton all over again, man.
Yeah, you keep saying Newton. I had to look it up. I think I was watching the stream when you were talking about Newton and I was like, what?
I think most people would have to look it up, to be fair.
Yeah.
Before my time, certainly.
Does that mean I can handwrite my code now? Does it handwrite code into VS Code Spaces or Code Spaces on GitHub?
If my handwriting's an indication, it'll just be full of bugs.
Maybe less bugs, you never know. It's real artisan code now because it was written by hand.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know, like the updates seem cool and the Apple SoC seem cool as well. I mean, when other people get really excited about it, I think I'm naturally used to seeing people be more pessimistic, like, oh, who cares about that update? It doesn't really do anything, you know, qualitative for me. Or is it quantitative? It doesn't do anything quantitative for me. But this was different. This across the board, it seemed like, wow, this could actually really be a game changer if they're actually able to do what they've been doing in the past on a desktop level.
Yeah, it's definitely been the most interesting keynote. I always get hyped up for them ahead of time. And then afterwards, it's kind of a letdown. I'm like, okay. So people always ask me, oh, you're so excited. What'd they announce? I'm like, I don't know, some new stuff.
Yeah.
This is actually something to talk about, I think.
Well, so Web Queen brings up something interesting in the chat and talking about this Scribble feature, right? She says that it's cool that it's built in, but there have been a lot of apps for years that have done it. And that specifically, I was reading a thread on Twitter about, you know, a lot of the Windows or Google OS people out there were like, oh, that's cool, but my phone's been able to do this for a long time. And someone brought up an interesting thing. It's like, Apple's never been one to sort of copy or implement features just so they're up to par or catching up with or keeping up with their competitors. And they've only ever seemed to really have been doing stuff like that when they're like, okay, well, we have a bigger thing in the works, but we're not ready to announce it yet. So we need to batch some updates to have something to put out there. And so that's when they add more of those sort of status quo quality of life features. I don't have any concrete examples of that, but that seemed to be what the sentiment was in the thread, people talking about it. So they were saying that either A, Apple is working on something really big that they weren't ready to announce, and so that's why they started adding more of these, like, you know, backfilling these features into the queue to fill up the time. Or I think that was, there was a B, and I'm trying to remember what it was, and I'll never be able to find this thread again because it's buried in Twitter somewhere. But that seemed to be what people were thinking, was like, maybe there's something really big that's in the works that they are sort of like pulling some of these other quality of life features into the system.
Something touchscreen Mac.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. That was something I brought up too with when I was talking to Jamie. I was like, well, I really actually do like the design updates that look like they're coming in Mac OS 11. And it looks enough like iPad OS. I'm like, okay, well, then the next leap isn't going to, like, I could actually see the next leap being like sort of a uniform OS, especially like they pushed, what was it, Catalyst? Is it Catalyst? They pushed Catalyst super hard this year.
Yeah, they sure did.
I've never really been impressed with Catalyst apps personally, like the Twitter app built on Catalyst, and the news app also built on Catalyst, and the performance has been not great, but they seem to push it really hard this year.
Yeah, they did, especially in the State of the Union as well. They spent a lot of time talking about it. And yeah, they definitely are pushing hard towards that.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what I think about WWDC 2020.
Dub dub.
Yeah, it was a quality presentation. I think they nailed it, like with the transitions they had. I love the transition where Air Force One had to like sprint to the next floor, you know, and they had like the music transitions in between. I thought it was great.
Oh, we'll put a link in the show notes to Jonathan Mann's Song a Day, where he took a bunch of clips from the keynote and put them to music and sang along with it and made a little chorus. And it's a little two and a half minute song about just with stuff from the keynotes. And then he reads a bunch of tweets from people like in the tech circles, like Marco and John Siracusa and stuff, and it's pretty cute, and it leans on the Craig Federighi talking about how when you rearrange your home icons, it goes into jiggle mode, is just like one of those things that everyone calls it, because how else did you describe what jiggle mode is except just say jiggle mode, because right. That's what it is, even though it's not an official term. It's just, I thought that was great.
Yeah, Greg actually sent me the jiggle mode song on YouTube. He texted it to me the other day. I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, I thought they knocked it out of the park. Again, I didn't watch the whole thing. I didn't go back and watch it. I only watched parts of it on the stream, but I thought it was, you know, a quality presentation for sure.
Also crazy, I knew Jonathan Mann. So he's, I think, brother of Merlin Mann. I'm not sure. He has literally been doing song a day for 4,100 days.
That's difficult.
Yeah, and they're all on YouTube, and it's just out of control, man. I can't believe he's still doing it. Like, I remember when I heard about him doing it years ago, and it's still going on. That's some dedication.
I used to do a thing I called 24 Bars, where I wrote 24 bars of a song every day for a while.
Yeah, I remember you mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah, it was fun, but yeah, I just get busy, then you start traveling, you're like, do I really want to bring the guitar with me this time?
Right, well, that's what's so impressive about it.
Yeah, that's a lot, that's many songs. many songs. That is really impressive. So in non-Apple news, what's going on in your world over there?
Oh, man. All right, buckle up. I'm going to try to fly through this. I wasn't expecting to start this 30 minutes in, but here we are.
I'm ready.
It's been a week, man. First, a little bit of follow-up. I talked last week about Ruby Encoder and their lack of support on Raspberry Pi ARM V8 64-bit operating systems. Monday morning, I go to Ruby Encoder, refresh, and they have the loaders on there. So now I have Roadham Radio Ruby code running encrypted and locked down on a Raspberry Pi. And it basically just worked. I had to update to Ruby, modern version of Ruby, which I should do anyways, right? So there's that dance of updating Ruby, then updating dependencies. And it's mostly just deprecation warnings. There are no really breaking changes, but deprecation warnings are scary. So I just do what I can to get rid of them.
Right.
And so that that's great. Like worth the price of admission there for getting Ruby Encoder up and running. And I mean, they honestly said 1 to 2 weeks and they delivered on that. So that was pretty awesome. Very excited about that. Now I got to go through a dozen Raspberry Pis and manually recompile and update Ruby on them, which is not fun, but
that's what the intern's for.
Yeah, I don't know if Bucky has enough dexterity to work the keyboard just yet.
Bucky would have to shave the fur off, otherwise he would short out the pies, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, fur would get everywhere. I was also talking last week about how I started moving all my stuff over to DigitalOcean on, basically, instead of trying to do managed hosting solutions, like GigaLixir or Cloud66 or Heroku or whatever. I was just trying to consolidate my applications onto one server just for primarily cost savings, but also just for fun messing around with servers. It turns out, if this week's any indication, I really like just messing around with servers.
Yeah.
And so someone recommended Daku. I think it was Kevin. I'll give Kevin credit in the chat. Daku. And you have some experience with Daku, right?
Correct.
You used it, what did you use it for?
I have two Phoenix apps running on Daku right now.
Oh, they're actually on there currently.
As of this very second, yes.
Oh, okay, cool. So yeah, as I mentioned before, I'm not really into Docker. Like, I have no experience with it, but Daku, as I was reading the docs, I was like, I think it was a Saturday or Sunday morning, and I was like, I didn't really have anything to do. I had a couple hours to kill. Let me look at this Daku thing. And yeah, now just a couple days later, I'm all in, man. It's just great. I found a tutorial for how to set up Phoenix applications. I have a DigitalOcean managed database. Got a bunch of my application databases pointed on there to it, you know, on there hosted, migrated them over from existing solutions. So I have a Ruby on Rails application, which basically just worked out of the box because the sort of, you know, Rails application just very well supported in general. I didn't even have to install any plugins. I just had to update a couple of dependencies, of course, push it, Rails application up to Daku, and just deployed it and it's running. Awesome. Phoenix application took a little more work, but really not that bad. And so now I have these couple of, you know, personal projects, client projects that are very low traffic, all running this little DigitalOcean instance with one database managed database with backups and everything. And I don't need redundancy. I don't need load balancing. I don't need containers, I don't need Kubernetes. I don't need all this orchestration. I just need an application server running that I can easily update. And I documented the crap out of everything so I can remember how to do it next time. And overall, it's tricky. As I mentioned last time, deployments are just hard in general. And there's lots of little sort of paper cuts. And sometimes you can't even figure out what exactly you're doing wrong, because especially when you're dealing with a tool that manages everything for you, it's hard to even know where things go wrong and where to start looking for them, because it's supposed to be sort of swept under the rug and abstracted away. And mm-hmm. if something goes wrong, some configuration goes wrong, or it's the wrong version of something, it's, log files sometimes don't really bear it out. Sometimes it's hard to find that stuff, and that took a lot of trial and error. But again, it just comes down to tracking those things down, documenting them for next time. And again, so far, I'm just very happy to have that, just like that tiny little bit of overhead for such a large gain. And then I've redeployed those apps multiple times with updates and stuff, and it's all just been fine.
So a couple of questions. So Green Jenny from the chat asked, out of curiosity, what took you to DigitalOcean versus Linode?
It's a great question, because I love both of them. I don't have a reason. except in hindsight, my reason is that Linode does not have managed databases out of the box. DigitalOcean does. And that's a big component. That's worth $15 a month to me.
That was my second question, was specifically, I happen to know that you are using a single managed database for your Daku setup. And in the Phoenix apps that I have running on Daku, Daku has a number of plugins you can install, and they do have a Postgres plugin you can install. So similar to Heroku, you can sort of just link a Postgres database to your app and just make them be able to talk to each other. So I was going to ask, why specifically the managed one versus a Daku plugin that sets up PG for you?
I want the application server to be more or less disposable and easy to recreate if I have to. I'm okay with the database living in its own silo and being managed separately. I know you can, most of the tutorials I looked at had you spinning up Rails or Phoenix with a Postgres thing alongside of it. And I just don't need or care about that overhead. I actually want all my crap in one place for the database. And
yeah,
it's so easy. Now that I sort of understand how Heroku's, their 12, what do they call it? Like the 12 facets of
12 factor,
whatever. Like basically using environment variables to configure everything. Now that I've got that burned in my brain, and now that I understand that you can just have a thing called database URL that just has everything you need in it, just so easy to configure. And so, yeah, that's pretty much all it comes down to, is just it actually ended up being more convenient that way to have those two things be separate.
Yeah. And it's always interesting, right? So the things that you're putting on Daku are very specifically hobby projects. They're not projects where you're trying to, maybe it might turn into a business, but also in the event that one might accidentally turn into a business, if you're in a managed situation, it's much easier to eject your stuff. Like you said, reproduce your application environment minus the storage on another server all alone if you need to, right? So it removes one, critical component from that moving piece of being able to rebuild it. Plus, it's $15, but you can put as many databases on it as you want, as long as you got enough connections available for it. And there's other stuff it's easy to bolt on a follower, basically like a read-only cache or whatever. It's easier, it's easy to do all that stuff. So if you can sweat the $15, it's a good deal. You can just keep slapping stuff onto it.
Yeah. And their interface for sort of managing the database is very simple. You can basically only create and manage databases and users. And then everything else you do, basically just have to go out to the command line or a regular SQL client to do, which, is not as hand-holdy as I would like it to be. But again, it's just a couple commands, change ownership of database so that, mix ecto migrate or mix ecto create or Rails DB create and set up whatever. Mm-hmm. Just to set up the permission so that can run. And then that seems to be enough.
Yeah, so Green Jenny is saying in the chat, the $15 is a great trade-off given the ease it's set up and config versus, I've never used Amazon's managed databases, but I have not heard great things about that stuff at all. So
I have, and it is very complicated. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've not really used any of the that stuff beyond Heroku, like cloud-wise. Like, I've never hosted a single application on any Amazon VPS or GCP or anything like that. I've not. It's always been Heroku or DigitalOcean for me. So, I guess those are what. That's why I keep going to DigitalOcean, is just because I'm comfortable with it. I know it. I already have stuff on it. But yeah, there's also a post I was reading today. I don't know that it says enough to. I might link it if I can remember where it was. But the title was something akin to just use managed data, like managed instances, please. Basically, I think this was in the context of like businesses, like. It almost always makes sense to pay more to use a managed instance, especially if you're a business, because, you know, they're saying the most expensive database instance on AWS was $100K per year, I think. And then they were saying that it would be hard to get a good DB administrator or architect for that price. So why wouldn't you use a managed instance in that case? Which makes sense. Like, the arguments make sense.
You got to pay a DevOps guy $150K a year to manage it, but...
Right, right. Yeah. So, yeah. It was basically just saying, like, yeah, just use the managed stuff. just do it.
Yeah, there's one more application I need to move there. It is my application that I have on GigElixir. I do enjoy GigElixir. I think what they offer is great. Again, to scale this application, and this is the backend for my Summits on the Air iOS application. It's a little Phoenix app with Live View and database, and does push notifications to Apple's push notification service. That's all it does. And it's, again, pretty low traffic. It's actually running on my Doku instance now. I just need to find a time to migrate the data over. And there's going to be a little bit of data loss there because I can't. It's, you have to move the database over and then just point the DNS, and people eventually go over there. So maybe a few accounts get lost or whatever, but it's not. There's no important data there. They can always just re-log in or recreate an account or whatever with a click. It's not a problem. I don't think anyone's going to notice. If I do it in the middle of the night, especially, like, it's not like anyone's out hiking in the US or Europe at 3 a.m. So I think it's pretty safe.
Yeah.
One of the other parts of this was dealing with static sites. Now, I know Doku can do static sites, and they actually have a first-party plugin just for managing static sites on Doku. Like, they have it on their GitHub. It's their one plugin that they publish officially. Man, I always come back to Netlify. It's just so great. My ham radio site, www1x.com. It's a Jekyll site. It was an old Jekyll site. Again, update some dependencies, push it to Netlify. It detected that's a Jekyll site. It built it, point the DNS at it, done. Never have to think about it ever again.
Yeah.
And it even set up the GitHub deploy hook. So when I just push to master, it just redeploys. Awesome. I also have this project that is really, really weird and janky, and it uses my own static site generator that I built 11 years ago now.
Oh, man.
It's a Ruby gem. It's on Ruby gems. It's called Chisel. No one should ever use it. It's 0.0.4 version. Like, it's whatever. But it's just a static site generator. So I took this repo. I pointed it at Jekyll. I said, hey, you know, read from this repo. It said, hey, this is a Ruby project, but it doesn't look like Jekyll's installed. This is probably not going to build. I'm like, yeah, whatever. I know what I'm doing. Shut up. Set the build command to just be Chisel, which builds the site, pointed at my output directory. It just freaking built, man. Just freaking built my janky ass Ruby static site generation application. What in the world? So great. So great.
Yeah, Netlify is consistently good. And I also saw, this is of like no consequence to you, but I also saw today that they're working on adding two-factor auth to it.
To what? To like the dashboard login?
Yeah.
Nice. I'm always a proponent of that.
Yep. It was funny because the person that was reporting it locked himself out of their account.
The system works.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Netlify for sure.
Every time I go into the database, I feel like there's more tabs across the top for features. Like, they're running out of space there.
Yeah, it is getting pretty full. But I don't know. I like what they do. They consistently put out good work, you know. They're doing the good work of pushing the Jamstack, so.
Yep. Anyway, so that's pretty much it for the saga of consolidation of applications. I think the big takeaway is now that I have this pretty simple, reliable, cheap way to have a production environment. I'm kind of using air quotes production, like it's good enough, right?
Sure.
The sort of friction required to start up a greenfield project, and one of the always concerns of that is like, oh, I'm going to have to host this thing. Eventually, if someone's going to use it, no matter what the project is, like, yeah, it could be some simple one-off. Oh, I have to host it. That's kind of a load off my mind now. It could be before, but you just have to throw money at the problem. And that, again, that's just a non-starter for something. So having the sort of freedom to have my own production environment that's inexpensive, cost me nothing to add applications to it. It actually technically makes it cheaper per application, the more you can throw on it, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say is in my Heroku approach, the cost of ideas that I might want to throw against the wall, see if they stick, is minimum $7. So that became a factor when you start getting 3, 4, 5 ideas that you may want to stick. Like, okay, well, now my monthly bill is going up. Is this something I want to do? And again, I keep referencing Greg's post on side projects. Like, of course, not all of them should be businesses. Like, you should be able to build stuff for education and for fun and exploration and all these different ideas. And so part of the fun and exploration is sharing those with people. And if that costs you $7 a month, like that's something that you think about, and that's friction and going the other way. And there's already tons of friction to not shipping something, right? So yeah, I like your idea of technically it gets cheaper because I can just keep tossing more stuff onto it. And as long as my traffic like doesn't blow my server away, something doesn't pick up and knock everything else out, like it's fine.
I actually even tested it. So while I was deploying one of the applications, it runs Webpack to, you know, build all the assets, and then it runs the Beam compiler to compile everything. And, you know, I was looking at HTOP and the CPU's pegged 100%. I'm just over there in another tab refreshing the pages, and they're perfectly responsive. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Even while it's compiling.
Yeah, so I was actually working on Rodinia last night a little bit, and I actually looked at the same thing. I looked at the graphs, because on deploy it runs npm run build, and so it has to chunk all that stuff, which is not actually a lot, but the CPU was spiking up to like 60% on every deploy. And I was worried about it, but yeah, it was fine. It was totally fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And that kind of like leads me to a tweet that I wanted to talk like briefly about or mention at least, because, you know, I mentioned it to you yesterday and you have some thoughts on it, but it had a positive impact on me anyway. But the tweet was from Taylor Otwell. He's the creator of Laravel. And he said, searching for the one true way to build a Laravel application can be a very subtle form of procrastination. You should be aware of and monitor yourself for, within reason, thumbs up. And Greg and I were just talking about this, because Greg, I always talk to Greg about, I just ask him for advice all the time, right? Because I look up to him and where he's at, and I respect the work that he does, you know? So we were talking about languages, and we're talking about, okay, like, you know, I've got Elixir, which can suffice for like a lower level language, and I've got some Go, but not a ton of experience there. PHP or another object oriented could be like a good fit for like a mid tier language. And then obviously JavaScript on the other side of that, not that it's like a light tier or anything like that, but it's, you know, you can cover all the bases. And we were talking about career development and experience and sort of picking stacks to kind of narrow into. Right. And so everyone hears it that listens to the show, like me go back and forth on languages and like, I just lament on, but what if this isn't the right one, you know? And anyway, I come across this tweet and it just hit me at the right time. I was like, oh yeah, I should just shut up and just write some code instead, you know? And so that's what that tweet did for me, was instead of not, you know, thinking about the one true way to build a Laravel app, what it did for me was like, just write some code, you know, just shut up and produce something instead. So that's what I did. And it felt good. I shipped a new feature to Rodinia last night and I was productive.
Yeah, this is a very hard tweet to deconstruct, because it is kind of, you know, only Sith deal in absolutes, Sean. And this is just the worst case of that. I feel like it's sound bites are going to be, you know, come off as pithy or whatever. Like they're going to be, is pithy the right word? They're going to be polarizing no matter what, especially when you're in a tweet, even in the new world of long tweets.
Oh no. Yeah.
There's only so much, nuance you can convey in a tweet, but let's just generalize this beyond Laravel. searching for the one true way to build an application is a subtle form of procrastination. Let's just pick that apart.
Can be a subtle form of procrastination.
Says, yeah, can be, right? Okay, a little hedge in your bets there.
Yes.
The way this comes off is it makes you like feel bad for learning, which I don't like. I think that's what rubs me the wrong way about this. That
okay.
One way of writing code is just copying and pasting or Stack Overflow and doing everything like in one file and like not having any structured application, not making extensible and not make designing for change and future requirements or needs or performance, or there's all kinds of terrible, terrible ways to write an application that technically work, but are impossible to read or debug or extend or manage or upgrade. And like, there's ways to write applications for a reason, because applications solve problems, and the way the code is structured is designed to help you with that. It's just a tool, and just as the language or the framework itself is a tool, so are the design patterns and architectures and file names and variable names and everything you use that goes into designing your application is all like a means to that end. And so, yeah, on one hand, like you can get hung up just like sweating about using the right tool and the right architecture and refactoring until, you know, you're blue in the face. But that's also like a tool for growth. Like if you're not looking at your code and thinking it's gross, you haven't made any progress. You know, you look at code from 6 months ago, it should look wrong to you. You know, you should be making progress unless you're DHH and you're looking at your Rails code that you wrote. Like you have the right to sort of be critical of the only way you do things. And I don't think it's necessarily a form of procrastination. Again, it can be, you know, rewrites are almost never the answer. I say that completely hypocritically.
Sure, yep.
But
yep.
Like, you know, it's true. And I just think this is just, there's too many shades of gray here to like say this, even though this is very, this tweet is very, anyway, I'm getting all worked up, but I think that, there's definitely time for procrastination. Yes, that can be a problem, but actually spending time to refactor and architect things in a better way, I still think is a valuable use of time.
Right.
Again, within reason, right? Which again is in the tweet.
Yeah, and that's like the opposite of how I read into it, basically. So I would agree that yes, it's important to consider best practices, architecture design wise, everything like that. Yes, I agree that, you know, embracing refactoring where it makes sense, fixing things where it makes sense, you know, redoing something that was done wrong, that makes sense. And a point that you made about you should be able to look at the code you wrote 6 months ago and see it and be able to like, you know, make improvements on it or see avenues of where it could have been done different. Yes, that's all true. But you would have to have written code 6 months ago for that to happen. And in my case, I can get held up on reading articles and on architecture and reading things on you should do this, not that, and then someone else saying, no, you should do this on that, instead of actually just doing the thing. So I guess what I'm trying to advocate for is more firsthand experience and less relying solely on third party experience. And that's what that tweet meant to me, I suppose, up front was I need to get more firsthand experience as opposed to solely trying to ingest third party experience.
Yeah, see, when you frame it that way, that makes a lot more sense to me and seems a lot more pragmatic. I was going to bring up the example of sort of the Rails way versus the Phoenix way. And again, we talk about this
sure.
all the time, but
yeah.
Rails has conventions and the conventions exist for a reason because they help you build a certain type of application in a certain type of way. And for those type of applications, it's great and super productive. Whereas Phoenix, it does have conventions, but everything is much more explicit and there is no really one way to build an application. You know, they have a couple of suggested ways with their sort of concept of contexts. But again, literally, it's just functions, Sean.
Yeah.
It's just functions. And you do have the freedom to build the application the way that makes sense to you and learn along the way, right? Which I guess is what you're saying. And I think, you know, sometimes when I do start to worry about how something should be structured, I just start writing stuff into a big file and then worry about splitting up later. I did that today with when I'm learning Python, right? and like, I don't know the right way to write a Python application. So I started with a dot something dot py file and just start writing things. And as things start to split apart and I learn how modules and packages and all that importing works and scopes and all that stuff, okay, then I can start to figure it out along the way. But Green Jenny in the chat brings a good point. She says, I assume she, considering refactoring is worthwhile as long as you don't let perfect be the enemy of good, which of course is right. You can't write perfect code every time. You're not going to be able to anticipate every use case and cover all your bases there. It has to be good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I suppose I could have mentioned the first response to the Taylor's tweet as well, because I read that in line two, and it's by Chris Arter, and he says, completely agree, just ship software. Exilis comes from iteration, not from some magical single broad stroke of genius. And I think that's what really like pushed me into that idea of first party experience versus third party experience when reading his tweet, because excellence comes from iteration and not from some magical like inspiration that you get from something else. Because you can read, I've read a bunch of books, I've read a bunch of articles. That doesn't mean that I can put it into practice unless I actually iterate and try and do and fail and make it better as I go. And so I guess that's why I took what I took from it, is because that idea of excellence comes from iteration and not basically some blessed idea that come like just beams into your mind, I suppose. But yeah.
What, you don't hear the voices? You don't hear DHH in your head?
Well, I mean, the other thing too is like, I've been going through different code tests and trying to learn, like right now I'm working on React so that I can pass a test so a company will give me a job, right? And so this is also part of maybe my psyche coming out, like looking at like reading countless articles on like, okay, how do you React, how do you Redux, how do you what else, you know? And that's fine, but also I should just be writing React too. Like I have to be writing it in order to actually become proficient with it. Otherwise I can converse about it and I can sound intelligent, but when it came to implementing, that's a different story, right? And so for me, it's easy to do err on the side of conversing, e.g. like this podcast or stream. But it's much harder for me to go to the side of actually implementation and building. So yeah, that's what I felt good last night, because I turned around, built a feature, and I was like, check this out, Greg, you know, because we were actually just talking about that tweet and career building and all that stuff. And then I turned around and was like, build a feature, you know. So I got to try to keep that streak going, I suppose.
Sometimes you just got to write code.
Sometimes you just have to write code. Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was, I liked your take from it though, because it was from the opposite, like the complete opposite direction of from my take, and your take isn't any less valid. It's important to realize as well.
Yeah. It's just a different interpretation of what he was saying. And once you explained your perspective, it's like, oh, actually, yeah, I see where you're coming from.
I mean, I'm sure just like you find in Rails too, people just arguing over like, you shouldn't put your controller here, you should put it there, or you shouldn't structure a controller this way, or you should like structure this that way. And, you know, I'm sure there's plenty of just discussions about that. And I guess there's probably not anything wrong with bike shedding, right? And that's how you can move forward as a community, I suppose. But
well, it's a good outlet for side projects to take that role as experimenting. And, you know, you shouldn't be maybe trying brand new things in production. I'm, again, guilty of that.
Right.
Many times over. See my Rails application that is half converted to a beta version of the Trailblazer gem. What a train wreck that was.
So, I mean, one thing that Jaggy did that I thought was interesting, that initially I was like, oh no. But he's just like, all right, you know, we have to get to market quickly. We want to do things right, but if we don't ever actually do anything, if we just sit around and think about what designs we should follow code-wise, you're never going to get anywhere. So he's like, we'll just do it in the controllers and then move out of the controllers as we need to, move them back to places where they need to go. And so fast forward a month, and I haven't been writing code on it every day or every week even, and I jump in, and I'm like, wow, things are surprisingly easy to follow. And it's because we just do it in the controller first, and then we move it out when it makes sense. There's no premature optimizations. It's not great, but it works, and it's easy for people to come in and contribute to should they have to. So that was like a way of unblocking the problem of bike shedding too much up front and just making progress.
Hmm.
Right, right. There's also the other side of like, but that's not what controllers are for, right? But
yeah, I feel like that's an example of like, that's a known quantity. That's a known pain point in many applications.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, listen, if it gets you shipped out the door, I'm not gonna sit here and throw rocks. Like you guys are actually shipping things. I'm just over here not shipping things.
Yeah, I mean, as long as it gets fixed later, again, that's also a big thing of like people have intentions to fix it, but it's actually happening. Things are already being refactored and moved, and so it's cool to like see someone implement that. I like go that route, but also do the right thing along the way too. So it's, yeah, anyway, that's what I've been thinking about. Well, I know you have more thoughts on that, Rockwell, because I can see it in your face on the stream. But if anybody else has feedback or ideas or thoughts on everything that we talked about, you know, let us know.
As always, you can reach us on Twitter. The show is DNCcast. Sean is Sean Wash Bot, and I am Shruckwell. That's SCH Rockwell.
We're going to be putting the show notes at dnc.show. So everything we talked about today, the WWDC things, that interesting note about active versus passive Thunderbolt 3 cables that I learned about, you know, Catalyst, the jiggle mode video, all that stuff is going to be in the show notes at dnc.show.
Just put it in jiggle mode, Sean.
Jiggle mode. Someone made a Vim joke earlier. What was it? The jiggle mode. Oh, I think that's one of the hidden modes in Vim. Jiggle mode.
Jiggle mode.
Shout out to Green Jenny.
Colon J for jiggle mode. I don't know if that's true. You can watch us jiggle. twitch.tv/DNCcast. Thursday night, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. We're jiggling all night long.
And I guess I do want to say, too, like 3000 Thor just said, hey, really enjoyed the stream. Been a long time podcast listener, but never watched live before. Since we've only been doing this Twitch thing for maybe, I don't know, would you say a couple months now, maybe? I don't know.
If that.
And the show has been going for how many years now? It's kind of weird to think about it, but like since it's like 5 years or something like that. Yeah, we can say that like since we started doing this Twitch thing, it's been so much more rewarding because people are chatting in and they're interacting with us live and they're adding antidotes and anecdotes and asking questions. And that's all I really wanted, or that's all we ever really wanted in starting the show, was just to interact with people and make friends and just talk shop and help each other out, right?
Wait, what? I thought we were in it for the money and the fame and the ladies.
Right.
I was misinformed.
Yeah, so... but yeah, I just wanted to like make that note, like really thanks everybody for coming to the stream and hanging out with us and chatting with us. It's been really, really like fulfilling because there's been many points over the years of like, do people care about what we're talking about? Like they listen, but do they care? You know? And Twitch has really reaffirmed it. Like, yeah, there are people out there that care and people that want to interact, and that's been really, really rewarding. So, yeah, thanks for stopping by.
Yeah. Even on our first stream that we did, which was very barren, we still got more feedback from that one hour of streaming than we have in like all of the months before that from email or Twitter or anything. So
yeah,
it's been really good to actually have a conversation with people and get some feedback. So
yeah,
to know that you all are actually out there and listening, we're not just screaming into the void.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess last but not least, thanks to Spec for making this all possible, for putting us out there, for letting us get started in the first place. And if you're interested in other design and development related podcasts, head on over to spec.fm and check them out.
But there's something we said for a good scream into the void every now and again. Just let it all out. Just primal rage into the darkness. Right? It's healthy.
It's healthy. You got to get something off your chest, Rockwell? Well, I guess I'll talk to you next week.
Maybe a Python whiz by then. You just wait and see.
Oh my.
my only Python joke that I know.